Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Today's podcast is sponsored by ASHBRIT, a National Rapid Response Emergency Management and Logistics Company. Celebrating its 30th year, ASHBRIT has led response efforts following 60 federally declared disasters across 30 states. ASHBRIT is the trusted emergency management contractor for cities, counties, states, and for federal agencies. Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. I'm Eric Holdeman, your host. With me today is Meg Davis, a life and health coach. Given all the struggles that emergency managers, and I would say other government professionals, have in keeping up with the pressures of the job, I thought hearing from a professional about how we can better meet the challenges of having too much to do and not enough time to do it. Thus, we're calling it, and Meg will talk more in detail about this. So please join me in welcoming Meg Davis to the Disaster Zone podcast.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
And Meg, people know the first question I always ask, because I'm interested in it and it helps our listening audience know, well, who is Meg Davis in that? So what is your educational background, then your professional work experiences, and really, how did you get into becoming a life coach?
It's a great question. I get that one all the time. So when I was in college, I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Liberal Studies, and it was a really broad focus for a major. And I found that in addition to being interested in a lot of different things, one of the biggest takeaways that I got from this particular program was making a really diverse group of people a really productive group of people. And so that was really applicable everywhere that I went in my career after that. I found my way into several different high pressure industries. I started in hospitality and events. And then I transitioned into dispatching aircraft for an emergency air ambulance company, worked a year in police and fire and 911 dispatch. And then I spent some time working in mortgage lending while I was building up my coaching practice, before finally being able to go out on my own as a life coach. So in that time that I was in mortgage lending, I got my certification in life and health and wellness coaching. And I began to build my practice until I could finally kind of go out on my own. And I got into coaching because I never liked hearing someone say that people can't change or people don't change. And I think it's more accurate to say that often people choose not to change because it's hard and it's messy. And I'm not sure that anyone would ever really describe it as fun, but it's absolutely possible for people to change their habits and their patterns in order to get more of what they want out of life. I mean, I've gone through so much growth in my own journey that I feel like I'm proof that people can change. And so I wanted to provide the kind of support and resources I always wished I had when I was navigating my own personal growth. And I always tell my clients that I can't do the work for them, but I can make sure they don't have to do it alone. And to speak to my experience of being a coach, I love being a coach. It's so fulfilling and rewarding, and I feel so lucky to be someone who can say that they've made a career out of their calling, and I'm truly passionate about what I do. And I always find it to be such an honor when someone chooses me to guide them on their personal growth journey. And it's incredibly gratifying having a front row seat to watching someone pursue their dreams and achieve more of the life they always wanted. It's really motivating for me personally as well, because I make a rule to never ask the client to do something that I wouldn't do. So that means that I'm constantly pushing myself beyond my comfort zone in pursuit of my own growth.
Okay, all right. And how long have you been full-time life coaching?
I've been coaching for about 5 years now.
Okay. And yeah, with we're recording this on Zoom and all the other video conference teleconferencing capabilities out there, you can be a life coach without being physically in the same space, state, nation, I suppose.
Yeah. Absolutely. I have coached people. I'm based in Northern California in Sonoma County, about an hour north of San Francisco, but I've coached people in different states. I've coached people in different countries. So it's a really amazing way to connect with people.
Okay. All right. Well, who do you typically work with? The types of people, professions, women, men, and life coach is somewhat a new term. How does that compare to someone who's just seeking a counselor? Yeah, type of
Yeah.
person.
So I work with all different kinds of people. And from I've worked with people in their late teens to early 20s that were struggling with the expectations of society, and all the way up to people that are going through transitions in life like retirement or becoming an empty nester and wanting to figure out who they are and what they even like anymore after such a long time in a certain role. And then I work with professionals wanting to grow their current careers or move into new ones. So it's really broad, it's really diverse, men, women, people of all ages. There are coaches that work with that's best that work more specifically with children. I prefer to work more with adults or people who are becoming adults.
Yeah.
But really, I've worked with a broad array of people. And one of the groups of people I love working with the most are driven and motivated high achievers who find themselves struggling to achieve the success that they've become used to creating for themselves without the pressures of the high expectations that they often set, those standards that they hold themselves to, that they would never ask anybody else to achieve, and overcommitting in their schedules and needing to make things perfect and, those kinds of pressure. I find that these kinds of people are reluctant to remove those kinds of expectations because they fear it'll make them complacent, or that they'll never accomplish anything, but that's just not true. So overcoming that kind of mindset has been a big part of my own journey. So I love showing people that there's a better way and empowering them to achieve this excellence that they know that they're capable of, that they're so used to creating, without it leading to exhaustion or the exclusion of goals in other areas in their life. And then
Okay.
you asked about the difference between a life coach and a counselor or a therapist. So to oversimplify the difference, therapists are usually focused on the past and coaches are more focused on the future. So as a coach, I'll almost always talk with someone about their past, but instead of trying to analyze it in the way that a therapist would, I'm really more interested in discovering what methods have worked for someone and what insights we can pull from the past, from their past experiences, so that we can apply what's already worked for them to new strategies that we can build together.
Okay. All right. Well, we spoke last week in preparation for this interview. I mentioned the challenge for emergency managers of not having enough time or staff to do everything that's been demanded of them and their position. I mean, there's some very large organizations, emergency management organizations, that could have 10, 20, at state level, hundreds of staff, and then it's scaled all the way down to someone doing the job part-time as an additional duty. So they can't do everything. The phrase is popular, doing more with less, probably 20 years ago that was used. I was thinking, we're getting so good at doing more with less, eventually we'll be able to do everything with nothing. But what tips do you have for someone experiencing this type of challenge? They can't do it all that's being asked of them to do. And I would say, you mentioned perfectionism or the perfectionist. Boy, you don't want to get in this industry. I'll tell you, because there's no way you're going to be able to do everything perfectly. So, what do you tell people?
I'd say the number one strategy that I would recommend people really embrace and make sure it's working for them is prioritization. And it's really essential to help manage the demands that seem impossible to keep up with. And I'm sure your listeners are no stranger to prioritization, but making sure you have an effective strategy for prioritizing tasks can make a big impact on mitigating stress while you're maximizing your efficiency. So, if you haven't revisited your prioritization strategy in a while, I'd recommend starting there. So, like most things in your life, our work is an ever-evolving thing. So you'll want to make sure that your approach to prioritizing aligns with certain criteria, like does it support your current objectives? And is it reflective of what you can realistically get done in a day? And does it help you properly allocate your time by identifying the urgent versus the important tasks, in addition to which tasks will require the most effort? And finally, does it allow you to be flexible and adapt to surprises, including which tasks to cut from your list? Because to your point, you will never get everything done. And so when you do find yourself needing to remove items from your list, I recommend you try to focus on the ones that'll give you the greatest sense of accomplishment at the end of the day. So revising an existing strategy can be a really empowering thing. I want to make sure that people know it doesn't mean that what you were doing before was wrong. It's what I always like to remind my clients is that what got you to where you are isn't going to get you to where you want to go. So I always recommend that people are constantly reviewing and honing the practices that they use on a daily basis.
Okay, I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's old school now, because again, that was 25 years ago. Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and you talk about habits in there. And I participated, our management team at Washington State Emergency Management collectively went through this together. And I just remembered it included some video pieces. It was he had this glass tube, and the goal is to put the big things in first. He used big rocks as an example, as for prioritizing, do the big things first, and you add pebbles and finally sand and water. That was the visual aspect to it. But where do you put in self-care in those big things, maybe type of deal? Is eating right, exercise, is that vital to being effective as a person?
Oh, absolutely. Self-care is so important. And it's one of the things that I think people who are wired to be in the service of others often forego as unimportant or not the best use of my time, especially when you've got a task list that you know you're not going to get done. How does it feel good or right to put yourself as a priority in there? But it is so important because the things that self-care does, even if it's spending a couple minutes just breathing or taking small breaks throughout the day regularly, which can be tough if you already feel like you don't have enough time. But it's so important because it reduces stress, it helps to improve mental clarity. It's got so many benefits. And then of course, once you're out of the office and you can do things like making sure that you're eating well and exercising and getting enough sleep, those are things that we hear about all the time for a reason. They make a huge impact on how we're able to show up, not just for the people that we serve, but for ourselves. And we always, in coaching, we always say that you can't pour from an empty cup. And so if you're not refilling your own supply of energy and ability to be present, then it minimizes actually what you can do for others.
So you're talking to a recovering workaholic. So I haven't been to a meeting in many years of Workaholics Anonymous. But so you got, three major pieces: eating healthy, sleep, and exercising. So you got somebody who says, "Well, I can't find time to do any of those things." Is there one of those three that you would emphasize over the others?
I think sleep is the most important for everyone. Just that's kind of, I always have a hard time with coaching and coming up with one size fits all approaches because I think it is so customized and specific to the individual. But I think sleep is the number one thing that everybody needs, no matter what, no matter what your other health factors are. You always need. The target is 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. And then from there, I would want to talk to the individual and make and get to know them a little bit better to see if diet or exercise would come after that.
And I'll admit to you that I really functioned on 6 hours of sleep the majority of my professional life. And last, 4 or 5 years, I said, "Okay, I'm going to get 7 hours of sleep," and that's what I pushed myself to do. But I call myself semi-retired. I don't have to get up in the morning and go to a job anymore. And it's amazing. I thought, well, I could never sleep 8, 9 hours. Oh, yes, you can. Yes, you can. So go to bed at 10 and wake up at 7, although I keep waking up at 6:30 in the morning. But that's getting up there. And you do feel, I could actually read a book without falling asleep. So that's very true. So we've talked about this, but I'm thinking emergency managers are listening to this conversation. And this issue of how do you choose what to work on when everything is important. There are disaster plans to be written or updated, procedures to be maintained for when there is a disaster, training to be conducted, grants to be applied for and then administered. And then we're supposed to be maintaining relationships across the community, doing public education to help people become better prepared as individuals and families. All that is just exhausting. So it's great to say prioritize, but I just listed all of those. They're all supposed to be done. How do I prioritize? Do I say, okay, community, when they call and ask for a disaster presentation at their club or whatever, and say, no, that's not my priority, or you're not going to get the emergency management performance agreement funding unless you apply for it. So, well, I'm not going to prioritize that. We need a disaster plan first. So what do you tell? I'm your client here. I just told you I got to do all these things.
Well, there's lots of different ways to prioritize tasks. And depending on your preferences and the nature of your work, but one common method that I really like is the ABCDE method. And that assigns a letter to each task based on its value. So A would be for the most important tasks, B would be for the important but not urgent tasks, C is for the optional tasks. D is for the tasks that can be delegated, and E is for the tasks that can be eliminated. And you can add numbers to each letter to rank the tasks within each category. So, for example, A1, A2, A3. And you can use this method to focus on the highest value tasks and avoid distractions. And keep in mind that prioritizing tasks is not a one-time activity. You need to review and adjust your priorities regularly. And the situation may change. For example, you may encounter new tasks or unexpected issues, right? The nature of emergency management, lots of unexpected things, right? So, and feedback from others. So all of these things are going to have an impact on what your priorities are. So you might realize that some tasks are easier or harder than you expected, that some tasks are no longer relevant or necessary. So by reviewing and adjusting your priorities, you can ensure that you're working on the most important and urgent tasks and that you're meeting your objectives. And to that, you mentioned earlier about doing the rocks first and then the pebbles and then the sand. So it really depends on your style of working. There are some people that really advocate for doing the big tasks first. There are some people that they just work better when they knock the little stuff out and they know that that's not weighing on them and they can progress to the larger tasks. So I recommend people take some time to really sit with who they are and how they best operate so that they know what works for them.
Okay. Well, in this modern world, work does not have to end at the office, should you be at an office. So you can take work home with you. You can take work with you on vacations. Being a workaholic, I always took my laptop with me, and it worked with my wife, Mary. She was a late riser, and I would get up early because I was an early riser and I could work 2, 3 hours doing stuff, blogging, podcasting, or reading email before she was ever awake. And so it didn't interfere, if you will, with our vacations. That's how I worked
Yeah.
with it. But what advice do you have for people who have their work in a cart following them home every day?
It's really important to make yourself and your priorities outside of work just as non-negotiable as work is. We were kind of talking about this earlier with self-care. And for people that are wired to be of service to others and that serve such an important role to their community, it can be really hard to break away from that. But it's so important to make sure that you are investing in other areas of your life, like vacations, like relationships. Like those kinds of personal goals that you want to, maybe you want to eat better, maybe you want to sleep more, maybe you want to exercise more, maybe there's a certain hobby that you want to take up. All of those things are so important that you make non-negotiable.
Okay. All right. Well, one of the things having this conversation with you, I was thinking about it. We have a formal education system and all that, but there isn't anybody training people, certainly not educating them on how to work, right? It's kind of a self-discovery aspect. I was thinking about how it compares to how to study. I remember in college there were people, they just would do an all-nighter before the big test. That's how they studied, type of thing, to cram. And others were more diligent along the way, doing all the lessons and that. So what have you found about people trying to figure out how to work? Or it sounds like you've worked with kids still in school, maybe how to study type of thing.
I think it goes back to knowing yourself because there's so many different styles of learning, there's so many different styles of working, there's so many different ways of thinking. I was even just talking yesterday to someone who's a non-linear thinker. So knowing yourself and the way that you work and the skill sets and the areas of expertise that you bring to the table is so crucial to being able to figure out how you work best and how you how you work well with a team and knowing your, especially in a team environment, knowing the other members of your team and their skill sets so that you can be a really solid front and know when to delegate and who to delegate to.
Yeah, that's another whole deal about delegation. That could be an entire podcast, I think. Well, I think we're about halfway through. I want to take this moment for a quick break for this message, and then we'll be right back, talk more about healthy work habits, but then also this new thing of a multi-generational workforce happening in our lives. We'll be right back. Today's podcast sponsor, Ashbrit, is more than an emergency management and logistics company. The company's philanthropic arm, the Ashbrit Foundation, is passionate about serving communities before, during, and after disaster events. Their foundation's mission focuses on disaster-impacted communities, vocational schools, technical training, youth education, and mental health. You can learn more at www.ashbrit.com. And we are back talking with Meg Davis, a life coach. And Meg, I have another question to ask you here is, you know, in leadership, we have to lead ourselves first, but many times we might have someone above us, a supervisor, you know, demanding our 24/7 attention. I'm sure maybe, and emergency managers have this. I'll mention this later here, but how do you deal with that when the expectations are such from on top? I'm paying you a lot of money for this job. I expect you to be available whenever, and you know, they're texting at midnight and they want a response.
I think it's really important to set expectations and to have all team members on the same page about that. I think I know in some industries there's kind of a systemic culture of having this nonstop work 24/7 environment, and it's just not sustainable. There's nothing in life that happens 24/7 constantly without breaking down. It's just not, it's not realistic. So when we're talking, one of the biggest points of coaching is goal setting. And when we're talking about goal setting, it's all about one of the biggest points you want to make sure that you're taking into consideration is it realistic? And working 24/7 is just not. So I think it's important to have direct communication with supervisors and set expectations that you want to do a good job, that you want to be available, but that 24/7 is just not something that's sustainable and realistic for anyone.
Yeah. And it's the old thing, people don't realize this, when you go in for the job interview, remember you're interviewing them also.
Yeah.
What's the culture, right?
Yeah.
At the workplace.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I teased this before the break. You know, we're experiencing a multi-generational workforce with three generations working at the same time. Yeah, I'm a boomer. We're known to, you know, live to work. Newer generations appear more oriented on work to live as a mantra for how they live. And how do these different perspectives coexist in the same workplace? If you're the audience here is listening is coming from a multi-generational perspective, what would you tell each generation?
This is actually a topic that comes up quite a bit in professional coaching. And there's a lot of tips to facilitate better integration between multiple generations within one workforce. But I think a good short answer is making sure everyone is united under a common purpose. So when expectations and standards are made clear and accessible to everyone, a team has a lot better chance of putting aside what makes them different and embracing more of what makes them the same. Everybody wants the same outcome. So when we can connect over what makes us similar and the shared objective of the team, it just helps us to focus on how we can work together instead of all the ways that our work styles can be different. So once the expectations have been established, try to allow for some flexibility and when and where possible. So with things like methods of communication, like email versus video message, or working style, is it remote versus in person versus hybrid? And then for ongoing conflicts within a team, if that has arisen, I recommend bringing in a professional coach or trainer that can help in collecting feedback and facilitating educational opportunities that combat bias and stereotypes. Because even though on paper it can look like multi-generational workforces create challenge, it's actually, I think many employers and many organizations would find that there's some distinct advantages to having diversity in age of their employees. One of the benefits is having a broader range of knowledge and perspective that can help support creative problem solving. Some organizations have even established cross-generational mentoring programs where team members with more years of experience can advise younger employees on professional development and advancement. And in turn, younger employees can help train team members of a different generation on current trends and technology. So it can be a really symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, I tell you, my last position is with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, and small staff, nine people there, and just about everybody. There's one other person my age. They were all younger, and so they had much better technological skills than I ever will have. And it was great to have them to lean on, and they were always helpful to me. And I'm very appreciative of that. Sometimes they would come to me and ask me advice. I got this situation more experiential, not technologically, where I could, provide some ideas to them. I think I appreciate what you said. The circumstances can be so varied. You can't say you have to do it this way or that way. It's give people options of what they can do. And sometimes it's do nothing, which I'm more of an activist than do nothing. You know what I mean there.
Yeah.
The other thing maybe should have mentioned this earlier. One of the individual things is people should find somebody who they a friend or professional associate who they're accountable to, who they can go to, kind of like a life coach, but say, hey, I'm experiencing this or that, or could you give me a personal critique on how I could improve myself, type of deal. I tried that with several people who I'd call my friends, and they were unwilling to do it. They did not want to take on that role of criticism, I think. And any thoughts about that whole thing of being accountable to someone who knows more what's going on versus a life coach, because they could. I'm sure you figured out sometimes people maybe weren't representing themselves to who they really were or that. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a good coach can read between the lines and kind of quickly figure out when someone is caught in a story that is painting maybe an unrealistic depiction of what's actually going on, because the outcome speaks for itself. So to your point about asking friends to give us feedback, especially if it's critique or criticism, that can be really hard. That can be a really hard position to put someone in. And our friends or peers and family members aren't always the best people for that kind of role for a couple different reasons. The first is when it comes to helping navigate a situation that's particularly challenging, especially challenging to something that you might identify as one of your weaknesses, there's a certain amount of honesty and a little tough love that might be required in order to help you not just find the solution for the scenario you've come to them with, but help you be able to grow into a stronger leader for the future. And so peers aren't always the right people to administer that kind of feedback because it can either put them in an awkward situation or create tension in the workplace or within your friend group, or if it could lead to feeling judged by someone if it's their opinion and you might not resonate with their opinion or feel that it's entirely relevant. So working with a coach or someone that you engage with specifically to help challenge you is a really great asset.
Okay.
And the second
Well,
reason, oh, go ahead.
no, you go ahead. Second reason.
I think there's a second reason that sometimes peer groups aren't the best, especially when you're troubleshooting a work scenario. Sometimes an outsider's perspective can be really beneficial because peer groups can really look at something that we've always done it this way. And so it tends to fall back into familiar and similar patterns. And sometimes there's a reason that it's been done that way for so long. But when you get an outsider's perspective that isn't bound by the way things have always been done, sometimes you get a point of view that can help you shake things up a little bit. So it not only could be an asset to you and your team, but the industry at large.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I came out of the military. We had a very structured way of doing things, which is helpful. Everybody knows how to do it that way and that. But there was one of my employees, Richard Gelb, who more as a cerebral type of person, far from a military type thinker, but he was the guy who woke me up to the possibilities of, hey, there's talent and ideas come from everywhere. And, he launched me on my regional emergency management journey based on his thinking and coming to me and sharing his thoughts. So I absolutely agree with you on that. Well, while we get down more to the nitty-gritty, this wasn't one of my written questions, but we'll have an ad for life coaches here. So, all right, what would it cost me? Give me a ballpark. What is it to have a life coach? I expect maybe there's an hourly rate that can vary based on if you're the world famous life coach and versus someone else, but and how long is an engagement do you think is needed? What would be typical? Give me some in our audience a perspective on what that would be.
To not give you a solid answer,
Well, you
they range.
know.
It's pretty impossible to give you kind of a range because coaches are all over the map. There's some that you can work with them for a couple months for $1,000. There's some you can work with them for a year for, I think there's a master coach, and working with him for a year is $180,000. So
I'm not calling him.
he's got a very specific niche. But
Yeah, CEOs, I think.
yeah, so it's so broad. There are some coaches that only sell packages, and they have the requirement to work with them for a specific length of time. There are some coaches that work a little bit more like therapists and sell one coaching session at a time. So it's so broad. I recommend for people that are interested in getting a coach, I would recommend that you get really clear about what it is you want to accomplish with your coach in the first place, and find a price point that works well for you, but also find the most important part is to find the coach that you really want to be working with, because what you put into it is there's a direct correlation between what you get out of it. So find the person that you love talking to so much you would literally pay to talk to them, because
Yeah, that's a true statement, right? Okay, and so what do you think as far as length of engagement. I don't see how a one-off coaching session would be that good. What's your recommendation there?
There are times when, as needed, coaching sessions can be really helpful, especially within the container of like a more intensive initially. So, anywhere between 90 minutes to 3 or 4 hours. If you're just looking for a one and done kind of session or an as needed, I would recommend starting there. But that's actually in my personal practice, I really recommend working with someone and having an agreement that spans multiple months because change doesn't happen overnight. So it's really important to build that relationship. And then once we get to know each other really well, then we can maybe transition, once people have kind of graduated a little bit, we can transition into more of an as needed model. But sometimes it really depends on the person. There are people who come in for an hour once or twice a month and just kind of get what they need from that hour and work the rest of the time between that session and the next one to implement.
Okay. All right. Well, it's been very interesting. Now you could help me about 50 years ago with my workaholic nature, but I've managed. I dug myself out of the hole. But any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listening audience on anything we have talked about or perhaps missed?
I think there was a lot of really great questions today, and I think you hit on some really important topics for high achievers. So I just want to thank all the listeners that are in emergency management. It's such a high stress and such a high stress field and such a critical role to our communities. And I kind of think that outside of actual emergencies, the rest of the community doesn't recognize or see the roles that everybody really plays. So I just want to take a minute to give that recognition and to thank everyone for doing such a critical job.
Okay, I have an alibi question. So thank you for those remarks there. And the alibi is okay, I'm X looking for Y coach. Is there a certification of coaches so that you can tell one coach from another type of thing?
Their coaching is actually not quite as regulated as something like therapy is. So there's lots of different kinds of coaches. The nomenclature that coaches use to describe themselves is kind of all over the map. But in general, and there are certifications, there's life coaching certifications, there's professional coaching certifications, relationship coaches. So again, it comes back to get really clear about what it is you want out of the coaching relationship. And then usually for whatever it is you're looking for, you can find a coach for that.
All right. Thanks for that alibi, Coach. I just want to say thank you to Meg Davis for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a great time to spend this with you and to go over all of these really important topics.
Great. And no matter what your profession in today's world, we're all expected to be productive, ideally healthy at the same time. So we got some tips from Meg Davis, and hopefully our conversation today helped you along that path. And I will put information on Meg Davis in the show's description if you want to follow up. And now a reminder to everyone to be safe and think about what you can do today to become personally better prepared for the next disaster. If you like this Disaster Zone podcast, please share a link to it with your social media contacts. Thanks for listening and be safe.
Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.